Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Coal mine owner Andrew Jordan and environmental attorney Joe Lovett might have grown up together in Charleston, but have taken two completely different, even adversarial, paths in life.
In my career of owning my own operations, I've been sued twice, and it's by the same environmentalist, and it was one, and it's just basically the guy I grew up with.
Joe Lovett?
Yeah, Joe.
Two Tales of Coal from the Us and Them podcast coming up on this episode of Inside Appalachia. And we'll hear the conclusion to Dave Hathaway's struggle to stay story. He's a third-generation coal miner from Greene County, Pennsylvania, who was laid off for about 12 months. Now he's returned back to work, but things are different.
I mean, my whole crew's all young guys, like 25, I think 24, 20, 27. It's like the oldest guy on my crew.
You'll find these stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Lately, we've been following Appalachians and helping them tell their stories in our series called The Struggle to Stay. On today's show, we'll hear the final installment of Dave Hathaway's Struggle to Stay story. While he hasn't talked about his emotions all that much, he did admit that while he loves the camaraderie that comes with being a coal miner, he'd rather not go back underground if he doesn't have to. And we learned just how important it was to provide for his family. But doing that in rural Appalachian communities dependent on the industry is becoming harder with each new day. It's changing the dynamics of families just as it's changed the landscapes of our mountains. And later in the show, we'll learn how it's even affected some childhood friendships. We'll hear from two men who find themselves at opposite ends of the coal debate, a coal mine owner and an environmental lawyer. But first, we're going to hear from a Pennsylvania coal miner in our Struggle to Stay series. 38-year-old Dave Hathaway was unemployed for about a year. And when we left off last time, Dave was offered a job in Maryland, which meant he would have to leave his wife, Ashley, at home by herself to take care of their newborn son, Deacon.
And it was a day shift, but it was 4 days gone. Like, I'd be staying in a hotel. I mean, it was kind of hard to pass up. But, I mean, we agreed that I pretty much had to do it because I didn't have any funds coming in now. But, yeah, I mean, I was dead set on going. I bought, like, I had to go buy a razor for you had to have a clean-shaven face.
But just as he was about to leave, Dave got a call from the Cumberland Mine in Greene County, Pennsylvania. He didn't want to have to go back underground, but taking this job meant he could stay with his family and make good money. No other job came close to the pay. Here's the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier with the final installment of Dave Hathaway's Struggle to Stay story.
I visited Dave about a month after he started back at the mine. He dropped the 20 pounds he put on during his year of unemployment and had shaved off his beard, which had gotten pretty wild by the end of the year. Was it hard, I asked, getting back into the swing of things?
It wasn't. I mean, you close your eyes and open them, you could think you're at the Emerald. I mean, other than the guys, you know what I mean? I mean, my whole crew's all young guys, like 25, I think 24, 20, 27. It's like the oldest guy on my crew.
At Emerald, Dave had pretty high seniority. He was operating equipment above ground. Generally, the further away from the place they're mining the coal, the better. Whatever seniority Dave had at Emerald went away when the mine shut down. At his new mine, Dave was back at the bottom of the totem pole, even beneath the 20-year-olds he was working next to. He was working the section, the active part of the mine where they cut into new rock with a huge machine called a continuous miner. He handled advancing the mine's ventilation system at the face of the coal seam.
I mean, all I do is pretty much I stand up at the miner all day, 8 hours. Well, 9.5 hours. It gets pretty boring. Same thing every day.
Dave said it was hard to adjust, not just to the physically demanding parts of the job, but the hours.
Them first 2 weeks were ridiculous, man. I was beat.
Every week, he has to work a different shift. 1 week on daylight, another on afternoons, and another midnight.
Yeah, midnight. That was the first midnight shift I've worked in over a year. That was pretty brutal.
Dave was sitting at his kitchen table. It's one of those high tables you sit at with tall chairs. He walked across the kitchen to blow his nose. The Kleenex was black. He and Ashley want to move, not out of Greene County, just a little outside of city limits. They live in town and want a house with some land on it. Coal mining is the best way he can afford to do this. But in the back of his mind, he's still wondering, how long will this last? For years, coal mines have been getting more coal out of the ground with fewer and fewer workers, and the country is simply using less of it than it used to. In 2015, Pennsylvania's coal mines produced the lowest amount of coal in the state since 1894. Dave wonders, what happens when the longwall machine finishes the section of coal they're currently mining?
And, I mean, they're so short, too. Like, the longwall just, it's going to rip through them. Kind of thinking it might happen again. Like, because, I mean, I don't know. But we'll see when it happens. Ride it out again.
He says he'll probably be underground the rest of his time at Cumberland.
Yeah, I'll be underground probably the rest of a career there. Which, I mean, I'm not mad about it, but it does suck.
I ask him, what would he do if he could do anything else?
I don't think I could do anything else now.
Really? You could do stuff.
I could, yeah. I mean, it'd probably be, I don't know. Yeah, it's probably where I have to be. I don't know if I'd want to do anything else. I mean, I tried. No one would hire me. So, yeah. I mean, everyone else thinks I'm just a stupid coal miner too, I guess.
Dave has a pointed sense of humor. It's kind of like a coping mechanism, a way of saying, ah, screw it. He often jokes with Ashley that someday he'll move into a van and just live there. He says it so often, it's hard to tell whether he's joking or not. Ashley brings Deacon into the kitchen and sits the baby on Dave's lap while she washes up some dishes.
What'd you do with Grandma today?
Huh? Deacon is now 5 months old, and he's up to 20 pounds. The baby stares at my microphone and tries to touch it. It's got a fake fur windscreen that probably looks like a stuffed animal to Deacon.
Yeah. Hey, Daddy making that coal miner money now. You haven't seen that.
I ask whether they'd ever want to leave Greene County. Dave pauses, like it's a question he'd never spent too much time thinking about.
Yeah, but I don't think we'll move out of Greene County. We're stuck here. We're lifers.
Would you ever want to leave Greene County?
I don't know.
Dave says maybe once Deacon is in college, that maybe then they'll try and find somewhere else to live. Dave's son, Grant, is one of the big reasons why he doesn't want to leave. In a previous story, I've told you about Grant's wrestling match that Dave took me to, how he lost to a bigger, stronger, better wrestler. Well, Grant had another match that night. It would determine whether he moved on to the next round in his school's wrestling playoffs. He paced the floor of the gym while he waited for his turn to come up. Grant and another boy square off.
Get off your knees, Grant!
They're well matched, and neither of them can gain much of an advantage. Dave is in his seat just staring at Grant, who manages to go up by a point. Finally, the match ends. Grant ekes out a win. I give Grant a high five.
Good job, Grant. Excellent. So how'd he do? That was really good.
Yeah, that was good.
Did he win?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, 1-0. When he come out of bounds, that was an escape. Got one.
Ashley is there, carrying Deacon in on a car seat. So are Dave's father and stepmother. Dave roves around the gym, chatting with other dads and wrestling coaches. He knows a lot of the people in this room. Grant is beaming. The dejection he felt from losing that first match is gone. almost like it had never happened. He has a medal around his shoulders, which he keeps touching. That match was in March. In April, Dave suffered an injury when a rock fell from the ceiling inside the mine and hit his knee. He was on workers' compensation for months while his knee healed. He had to have surgery for his meniscus, and the knee still hurts, adding to the various injuries he's suffered over the years, including an ache in his lower back from a previous coal mining accident. I visited Dave a little while ago at his house. He told me if he'd gotten a different job when he was laid off, he wouldn't have gone back to coal mining. But now, a year later, there didn't seem to be any reason to think about what could have been. And even with his injury, he said he was happy to have a job at the mine. He had a paycheck. He had insurance for his family. And that night, he'd be headed back to work to take the midnight shift. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Reed Frazier.
You can catch all of our Struggle to Stay stories about Dave Hathaway and the rest of the people we've been following on our website. That's at wvpublic.org. And in 2 weeks, we'll meet the final person we'll be following in this series, 21-year-old Derek Acal, a native of Harlan County, Kentucky, whose mother and grandparents encouraged him to leave, to go to college, and look for better opportunities.
I got it in my head that I could make it out and actually be something for myself by myself.
But a high school football injury put Derek's plans of leaving Kentucky on hold. We'll hear what happens over the course of 1 year as this high school senior tries to plan for his future and decide if he will stay or leave Kentucky for good.
I want to get my own stuff. I want to get my my own car, my own house, you know. I want to have my own family, you know. I want to do a lot, you know. There's so much I want to do.
That's coming up in a couple of weeks right here on Inside Appalachia. Catch this series and all of our shows on our podcast. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts or on our website at wvpublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts. So we just heard a story about a coal miner who tried to find another job so he wouldn't have to go underground. But in the end, it was more important for him to be close to his kids and wife than move to another state for work. Though this may surprise people from outside our region, coal mining isn't the biggest employer here in Appalachia. So why are the politics and culture surrounding coal such a constant theme when people talk about our region or when politicians campaign here? Well, according to the latest Census Bureau numbers, there are more cashiers than any other kind of worker in West Virginia. The wages for a cashier often don't compare to that coal miner money. And we just heard from Dave Hathaway, who looked for a comparable job for an entire year after losing his job as a miner. Maybe politicians would rather talk about coal than health care, education, or the prevalence of minimum wage jobs. Here in Appalachia, the ongoing debate about the future of coal is much more personal because of the cultural connections in our communities. But at the same time, sometimes even people on both sides of the coal debate have close personal connections. I bet some of our listeners can recall their family's Thanksgiving dinners or family reunions where both environmentalists and coal miners sat down together. In a recent episode of the Us and Them podcast, host Trey Kay explores the strong feelings people in Appalachia have surrounding coal and explores his own family's connection to the industry's future in West Virginia. Let's listen.
Us and Them is about seeing the same story two ways. And nothing calls out for that treatment more than the story of coal in West Virginia. Today, I'm going to introduce you to two guys from West Virginia who see coal in completely different ways. One guy says coal is the lifeblood of the West Virginia worker. And the other guy says coal mining is why so many people in West Virginia are poor. Talking with them got me thinking about my own connections with coal. My grandfather worked in a coal mine. My mom remembers him coming home like he walked out of one of those iconic photographs. You know, with the whites of his eyes shining out from a jet black face covered in coal dust. On my dad's side, there was my great-great-great uncle, James Kay, the owner of the Kaymore Mines. I've known about that mine all of my life. I'd even floated past it on a whitewater raft, but you couldn't see the mine from the water, so I thought that I'd get a closer look.
It's a great path,
isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a nice path, but it's not easy to walk.
I asked my friend Stan Bumgardner to come along.
I mean, you can see how steep it is, and we're probably not halfway to where the mine site would have been yet. And they had to figure out how to get millions of tons of coal out of here and get the miners in and out of this place. That's pretty challenging.
Stan knows a lot about the history of coal mining and the history of West Virginia.
I'm the editor of Golden Seal Magazine, which is the state magazine of traditional life history. And the last 25 years I've been a professional historian one way or another.
And I'm noting that as we walk down this path, I've got hiking shoes on and you've got...
I'm not wearing shoes. I walk barefoot in the woods a lot. And, you know, the worst thing you get there is some, you know, some briars and some nettles. But around historic sites, you know, you probably should wear some heavy soled shoe because they're, you know, man-made things, nails, screws, sawed planks, parts of roofs, they get left behind and they can get in your feet. And I've had that happen. So I'm not going to encourage what I'm doing, but I love being barefoot in the woods in West Virginia.
So where are we?
We're in the New River Gorge, which is kind of our little mini Grand Canyon of the Appalachians. And the National Park Service has come in and they've preserved a lot of the area that used to be coal mines. I think there were 80-some coal mines in the New River Gorge at one point. I mean, now we look at it as kind of a beautiful area, and it's, you know, there's people whitewater rafting and rock climbing and hiking. But if we were here 100 years ago, we wouldn't be able to see the other side probably. There would have been so much smoke and really smog coming out from the coal mines and the coke ovens and everything else that you wouldn't be able to see or even hear.
We're hiking down to the abandoned mine.
There's a Kaymore top and there's a Kaymore bottom.
Kaymore bottom's about 1,000 feet below us. There were more than 100 houses down there back when the mines were operating in this valley. A pulley system ran up and down the gorge, sort of like a chairlift on a ski hill. It hauled coal and people up and down this incredibly steep hill between Kaymore bottom and Kaymore top.
What can you tell us about why it's called Kaymore?
Well, it's named after one of your relatives. Is it your great uncle, James Kay?
Actually, I did a little research before this. I think he was my great 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 uncle.
From everything I know about him, he was kind of worked himself up from having nothing. He was born in Scotland, and I think he comes to the United States after the Civil War. He's his early 20s. By trade, he's an engineer. He can build roads, he can engineer things, and he helped build a lot of the bridges and archways that go through the whole area, because there's so many areas the railroad had to cross rivers, and he was pretty much a genius at it. And then he built his money up and he was able to buy some land.
The opening into my uncle's old mine is partway down the gorge between Kaymore Top and Kaymore Bottom.
This was the mine entrance, and it's been all gated off because a lot of people would wander into mines. I mean, they were fun places to go, and you could find scrap and such, but they were very dangerous, and they still are, especially abandoned mines. And you can see here, just at the entrance of this, how much slate has fallen from the roof. It's probably the main thing that killed more miners than explosions, was just a slate fall from the roof. My great-grandfather lost his leg in a coal mine, 1905, and this was the cause of it, was a slate fall.
Stan's family has coal stories. My family has coal stories. Lots of families in West Virginia have coal stories.
I mean, at one point there were, I think it was 1948, there were some like 125,000 people employed in the coal mining industry.
But the number of people working in West Virginia's coal industry has been falling for a long time.
Beginning in the 1920s, you know, coal was overproduced and the value started dropping, market value dropped, and there were a lot of layoffs and a lot of depression in coal towns. Coal towns started shutting up then. And then you have a little bit of a peak in the 1940s again when during World War II, specifically because of that. And then by the 1950s, with the end of the war and mechanization in the industry, I mean, the bottom falls out of it. And, you know, literally probably 100 towns just disappear. I mean, they become ghost towns within years. And Kmore's one of those.
At the opening of the Kmore mine, there's still a faded sign that says, "Your family wants you to work safely." I stood underneath that sign for a few minutes, and I could feel myself slip back in time. I could imagine the noise and the bustle of the mines. I thought of my relatives. On my dad's side, the mine owner, James Kay, a brilliant engineer who built this mine and that pulley system. And on my mom's side, her dad, Dick Jones, who carried his lunch pail into a different mine and dug the coal. Even though my family has ties to coal, I didn't think about it much when I was growing up in Charleston. I was a city kid. My dad was a lawyer. I had a vague sense that coal was a big deal to the West Virginia economy. There was this television ad. "Coal is West Virginia." I'm sure everyone who grew up in West Virginia in the 1970s can sing that jingle. But coal was pretty distant from my day-to-day life. And the kids that I went to school with didn't talk about going to work in that industry. But I did know at least one guy in Charleston who wanted to work in coal.
My name is Andrew Jordan, and I own coal mining companies in West Virginia.
Andrew's driving me up to a coal mine that his company operates just outside of Charleston.
Pritchard Mining Company is one of the first company that we started, you know, 25, 30 years ago. Yeah.
We both grew up in Charleston, and back in the day, Andrew and I went to the same high school, George Washington. Everybody calls it GW.
It was up this hollow where I first went to work.
Andrew got his first coal mining job right after he graduated from GW, and just before he went to Penn State to study mining engineering. That summer before college, he worked in the mine safety department.
It was good. Great big coal mine. And they're still mining coal in that mine today. And that was in 1977.
What did your parents think when you said, you know, I'm 18, I'm going to go just get this job mining coal? What did they think of that?
They didn't mind it. My mom's father was owned a Chrysler dealership in Charleston, but he also owned some small coal mines. So she'd been around it. And then her grand, you know, the generation that was really active in it was my great-grandfather.
Here's one impression that strikes me as I listen to Andrew. He genuinely enjoys mining. He seems happiest when he's out on the work site in Carhartts and steel-toed boots.
But I can wear the suit if I have to because I've been chairman.
Andrew's on the Charleston City Council, and he's been the chairman of the West Virginia Chamber of Commerce. And he's been the chairman of the State Coal Association.
I go to state capitol and lobby on behalf of our industry. So I can wear a coat and tie and a suit when I want to or when it's necessary, but I'd just assume not to. You know, I prefer doing this. I like running equipment. You know, I try and run a piece of equipment at least, you know, 4 or 5 times a week.
Andrew takes me up the mountain where his crews are working today. Some guys are driving around in dump trucks as tall as 2-story buildings. Other guys are drilling into the mountain to insert explosives.
This is the active area. This is where they're getting ready to blow things up. This is where we chisel the mountain down. Every level, where it looks like there's a little flat, that's where coal seam is. Okay.
Later that afternoon, they'll clear everyone out and set off a blast. That'll expose more of the seam, where they'll dig up the coal.
Hey, Ed. So, hold on, Ed.
We also stop in a spot that's no longer being mined. Now it's a field of soft green grass. At the edge of the field, the mountain begins a steep decline into a hillside thick with trees. Andrew tells me that people have mined this location for years, long before his company started mining on this mountain.
So this what was a mountain? I mean, how much did we reduce it from the top?
We
did. Elevation?
We're back to the same level it was.
How did you do that?
Well, you put the material, but you build it back up. You know, the material, that it's a constant. This is like a big road construction job. But we're held to put the material back to the approximate original contour. So it has to be brought back to the same level.
Andrew talks a lot about rebuilding the mountain, about planting trees. In the mining world, that's called reclamation. And Andrew says the big mining companies didn't do it.
This whole thing was being mined when we were kids. And there was no reclamation. There wasn't any laws. They just came along here with the dozer and whatever they could gouge out to get the coal and never come back. They just leave it, you know. That was going on when we were growing up. Here, where we're riding around. And now we're cleaning it up. This was just a little pissy-ass stream. This was a small stream.
For the podcast, you can say pissy-ass if you want.
And we did a lot of work on this stream, enhancing it for fish and wild, you know, aquatic life.
How much do you cross swords with environmentalists, and how often does that happen?
Well, in my career of owning my own operations, I've been sued twice, and it's by the same environmentalist, and it was one, and it's just basically the guy I grew up with.
Joe Lovett?
Yeah, Joe.
He was in your high school class.
And I would still consider Joe Lovett a friend of mine. Joe grew up four or five houses up the street from me. I mean, we at that time were very, very close friends, and I would still consider Joe a friend. But, you know, he looks at coal mining and fossil fuels differently than I do.
That was mine owner Andrew Jordan speaking with Trey Kay, the host of Us and Them, a podcast from West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Coming up, we'll hear from Jordan's childhood friend, Joe Lovett, and get his take on coal's impact on West Virginia.
Coal has been a curse upon this region since it was first mined here. And I think that anybody that looks at it rationally will come to that conclusion.
That's coming up in just a minute. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Before the break, we heard from Andrew Jordan, a coal mine owner who grew up in West Virginia. It's part of the podcast Us and Them. In this next part, we'll meet Andrew's childhood friend, Joe Lovett. Joe is the executive director of Appalachian Mountain Advocates, a nonprofit law and policy center that works in West Virginia, Virginia, Kentucky, and Tennessee. Here's Trey Kay.
Before the break, my friend Andrew Jordan, the coal mine owner, told me that he'd only been sued a couple of times, and each time it was by a childhood buddy, this guy.
I'm Joe Lovett, executive director of Appalachian Mountain Advocates, a nonprofit law and policy center that works in West Virginia, Virginia, Kentucky, and Tennessee.
I know Joe, too. I've known him for years. Our dads were really good friends. They were both lawyers.
Right. They were pals and I think did a few cases together as well.
I'm a few years younger than Joe and Andrew, so we weren't really good friends when we were kids. But Joe says that he and Andrew spent a lot of time together.
I grew up down the street from Andrew, and we were friends all the way through school. I played a lot of football at his yard and hung out at his house quite a bit. So, yeah, we were definitely good friends.
He told me that he's only been sued twice for his work, mm-hmm. and that both suits came from your organization.
Well, I think we've only sued him once. I think we sued the Army Corps of Engineers to stop a permit that he was trying to get. And that probably felt to him like we were suing him because in effect, it would have stopped a mine that he was trying to permit. And then recently, the organization that I work for and the organization that I run, you know, to be honest, has sued his company for water pollution problems. And, you know, there's obviously some personal misgiving about that. But
what do you mean?
Well, you know, it's hard to sue somebody who you know. It's easy to sue a publicly traded big company like Alpha or Arch. I mean, you know, they're shareholders mostly in St. Louis or Richmond or, you know, New York or wherever. But, you know, Andrew and his family have been in this region for a very long time, and the money gets spent here. Like I say, it's much easier to sue a faceless entity when you know that all the money especially is leaving the region.
Joe didn't plan on becoming an environmental lawyer. He didn't plan on staying in West Virginia. After high school, he went away to college.
I left, didn't really intend to come back.
He ended up in law school at UPenn. But during a couple of those summer vacations, he came back to West Virginia to work at the Appalachian Research and Defense Fund.
Otherwise known as AppleRed.
And Joe really liked being back. So when he finished his law degree in the 90s, he moved to West Virginia to work in a new organization called Mountain State Justice, which needed an environmental lawyer.
I graduated from law school and I clerked for a judge, but I didn't really know the first thing about environmental law.
But he dug in, and he became the only environmental lawyer in West Virginia.
Nobody was doing environmental law in West Virginia. I mean, there just wasn't anything going on. You know, when I started out, honestly, I was in the first case we had, there were like 14 lawyers on the other side of the case, and there was me. It's true that West Virginia is completely dominated by coal. There's just nothing like it. Our land is owned by out-of-state land-owning companies that work with coal companies to exploit the land. It's happened for decades. On the other hand, West Virginians generally are close to the land, and the people here understand how important the land is. So my client is usually Sierra Club or some group of people from, often from out of the state. And those people live in San Francisco or Washington or somewhere like that. And, you know, for them, I think it's, much of this is abstract. You know, I mean, they understand the issues with climate change and coal and air pollution and coal, but they really don't understand on a day-to-day basis, you know, what coal mining has done to the communities in which it occurs. And the people that live there know.
So here's something Joe and Andrew agree on. Folks from outside don't get it. They don't understand how deeply coal is ingrained into the life of people in West Virginia.
Coal mining in West Virginia is a culture.
This is Andrew again.
There's a lot of people that have done it for generations, and their dads and their grandfathers, and they lived in the same hollows that they've lived in all their lives. You know, there has been downturns in the coal industry since coal mining started, but if you talk to a lot of the people that have been in the business for a long, long time, they'll all tell you that this is the worst they've ever seen it. They talk about, you know, bringing money in to retrain coal miners. Well, here in West Virginia, because we don't have a diverse economy, what are you going to train them to do? They've been generations of coal miners, and they don't want to do anything else. All they want to do is go back to work. They don't want to check. They don't want a government handout. I mean, they'll take it in order to eat and exist. But, I mean, they just want to go back to work. And, you know, most of the guys that work for me that are laid off would say the same thing. They just want to go back to work. And that's what I want to do, is I want to put them back to work. And I want to be able to mine coal in a responsible manner, going forward to supply the energy that drives the economy of the United States.
There's no doubt that when we grew up, coal was king in the state, right? It was king coal. Everything was about coal.
This is Joe again.
All the big players here are gone. They all went bankrupt. Alpha, and Patriot, by far the two biggest surface miners in this region, both went through bankruptcy, and nobody's going to open a new mountaintop removal mine in this region. It just doesn't make sense. The economics aren't there. It would be pouring money down the drain. That's why everybody went bankrupt, took the money, and ran. Think of it this way. The coal industry came here 20 years ago, blew the hell out of our mountains for 15 years, destroyed it, left us a wasteland. Then they all went bankrupt, took their profits out, left West Virginia, a total mess. All of our streams are polluted, and I mean all of them, from surface mining, the forests are gone. So they destroyed the economy, and now it's going to be left that way for decades and with no real hope of recovery. So Andrew's a small operator, right? I mean, he's a small, I mean, he's not like the big guys that were here that were really mining the coal are gone. Andrew mines a tiny amount of coal. And, you know, I'm not saying there won't be a few local operators here mining coal in the future, and Andrew may well be one of those, but it's a pittance. It's a tiny amount. The coal fields, the billion-dollar coal fields, as the sign used to say when you drove into Logan County, West Virginia, are some of the poorest counties in the United States. Coal has been a curse upon this region since it was first mined here. And I think that anybody that looks at it rationally will come to that conclusion. I don't think it's coming back, and I think it's the best thing that ever happened to this region.
I've heard that before.
That's Andrew again.
You know, I disagree with that. I worked for some really good guys that were in the business. I learned a lot from them. You know, there's people like Lawson Hamilton, Buck Harless, Bob Long. These were all independent co-operators that, much like myself, understood the value of giving back to the community. They lived here. They worked here. They employed people here. They banked here. You know, it's very important to them that they do it right. And so mining coal has been very financially good to West Virginia. And we've created a lot of jobs, a lot of support jobs. There's a lot of studies that think that for every one coal mining job, there's probably 8 support jobs. And my biggest concern right now is I think that West Virginia, with this downturn in the not only the coal industry, but the natural gas industry as well, that we could lose up to a third of our population. We didn't diversify our economy. And coal carried a lot of the taxes and financed a lot of things in this country, or in West Virginia. And we should have been thinking about that. I mean, I'd love to see diversification. I'd like to see a whole lot of manufacturing power plants come to West Virginia. The more of the plants, the better. Puts more people to work. A better chance that my kids will stay here and live here and work here. And that's what I want. I mean, I want them to have the same passion for West Virginia that I have, and the same desire to live here and raise their family here. But if there's no business here, that it won't happen, you know? And so I want diversification in our economy, and I want more industry here because they're going to burn more electricity.
About a third of the country's electricity is produced by coal. When I started this, by the way, just 20 years ago, it was almost 60%. So it's dropped almost in half since I started. But still, a third of the country's electricity comes from coal, and that has to be mined somewhere.
It's wonderful to say that solar and wind are, you know, zero carbon, but they're not base load electricity. You don't have the ability to be able to turn that switch on every time you need it in every part of the country, like you do with nuclear, coal-fired, and natural gas-fired. They are a continuous source of electricity. And you know, technology will catch up with that. And down the road, you know, we'll be able to store more of the energy that's generated from windmills and solar panels. But that technology is not there yet. And the materials that are used to build some of those solar panels and batteries are not the friendliest to the environment to mine the minerals that go into that either. So, I mean, our mere existence has an impact. I mean, and we would be naive to think it doesn't. Like I told you, I've planted a lot of trees. I think I'm more of a practicing environmentalist in the things that, and my employees are, and the things that we've done and the trees that we've planted and the messes we've cleaned up than the guy standing on the corner of Capitol Street holding a sign that says stop mountaintop removal. We practice it every day.
Coal is the biggest environmental problem in the world. Well, let me strike that. It's certainly one of the top environmental problems in the world. I didn't realize that. When I came back to West Virginia, I had never been on a coal mine, did not think of myself as doing coal work. It just was like when we grew up here, nobody really thought about the environmental implications of coal mining, at least no one I knew. I personally just missed the whole thing until I came back.
Andrew, we met in his office, and then he drove me up to one of the strip mine operations that is not far from, if you're on the West Virginia Turnpike, where the old Memorial Tunnel is, yeah. And you go up on that mountain, right. And as we were going by, he had already shown me back in his office photographs of some of the places that they have reclaimed, reforested, that in many ways this has come back, that you would hardly know that mining had gone on there.
So I think Andrew makes an effort to do reclamation better than others do. That's purely anecdotal. I don't have any evidence there. I don't know, but...
Andrew says that he's an outdoorsman. He hunts and he fishes, and that he even hunts and fishes, around the area where he mines. Yeah. And so do his workers.
Sure.
He says that he and they care for the land and the environment.
Right. I don't doubt that at all. So evidently, mountaintop removal makes turkey and deer hunting easier because it creates these areas where there are edge areas between forests and open areas. But our ecosystem here is not about turkey and deer. I mean, that's part of it, but those are parts of the ecosystem. And the parts that people don't notice are what's lost forever. The birds, the insects, our forests, those are gone. I don't doubt that Andrew is an outdoorsman. I just think he doesn't understand what he's doing. I'm sure he thinks the same thing about me, but...
Well, yeah, I think that he would say, and I think that most people would say, is that, Joe Lovett is a guy who is a tree hugger, who cares more about the spotted owl than a guy who is trying to support his family.
Right. So I just looked this up. I couldn't get the exact quote, but the great Upton Sinclair quote, "It is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it." And that's what's going on here.
And I guess that's kind of the interesting dynamic, is that we have this industry that for 150 years has been a big part of our state's economy now, but more when we were growing up, it was hard to be a West Virginian and extricate yourself from the industry.
Not only when we grew up, it has been until now. As I said, I truly believe, I have been here now for 20 years, essentially suing the coal industry, coal-fired power plants and coal mines. And I truly came to see myself as part of the coal industrial complex over that time. I mean it. I was just without them, I wouldn't have had a job. I mean, I would have been happy not to have that job, but I was supported by the coal industry. I sued them. When I won, I got money in attorney's fees. That allowed me to hire people and sue them more. So my job was completely, it's not so much now, but until 2 or 3 years ago, was completely tied up with the fortunes of the coal industry.
For the record, my job has been tied to the fortunes of the coal industry too. Let me explain. As I say at the top of every episode, Us and Them is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is a part of the state of West Virginia, meaning that it's funded through state taxes. These taxes are predominantly accrued through the sale of coal. And over the last 10 years, WVPB has seen a dramatic decrease in the state budget appropriations because of a decline in coal mining revenues. Just this year, the state legislature wavered between cutting West Virginia Public Broadcasting's entire allocation, which essentially would have shut down the state's only public media system, or cutting its budget by $1 million. Fortunately, if I can say that, the governor signed a bill that only reduced WVPB's budget by $1 million.
But regardless of Cole's lessening contribution to my or Joe Lovett's income, Joe does have some praise for Andrew being more responsible than some of his mega corporate coal mining counterparts.
Most of the mining that's occurred here has been done by people who never even or rarely come here. So they have no interest in the future of the region. So I have no doubt that Andrew is trying to do a better job than other people are. But Andrew is still putting dirt in water. It's just a fact. He can't mine the way he's doing without putting dirt in water. Think of the mountains, right? Every mountain in West Virginia has streams that start nearly at the top and run down. And Andrew will blow up, that's not just Andrew, a surface mining operator just blows up the whole mountain. And then they try to put it back. But a mountain in West Virginia, before a coal operator gets a hold of it, is typically very steep. Mining spoil can't be put back after a mountain is blown up at that same angle. It's too steep for the soil to stay in place. But because of litigation, they have to put more back on top of the mountain and less goes into the streams below. But they're still putting big amounts of spoil in what were once streams. I don't put Andrew in the category with Alpha, Arch, and Patriot Coal. I'm sure he cares about the state. I think he's completely misguided in what he thinks the proper prescription for the state is. I don't think he could be more wrong, but I don't think that he is like in the same category with those other mining companies that I mentioned.
Andrew says that he knew your father quite well and attended his funeral.
And I knew his parents very well. I mean, our ties go way back.
He says that he still considers you a friend. What about you?
Well, sure. I mean, I think that it's, I have no bad feelings for Andrew at all. I respect him. I have to be honest, I mean, we haven't seen each other very much over the past 20 years. I run into Andrew from time to time. I'm still a friend, but I just want to make it clear. I mean, it's not like we hang out together, you know, not for any reason. It's just that our lives have gone different ways.
Two West Virginians, a shared account of the past, but two different visions for the future. U.S. Census reports that West Virginia tops the list of states whose population is declining. Andrew Jordan mentioned earlier that he wants West Virginia to maintain its population, and he wants sufficient industry to keep his kids living here. For him, coal holds the promise for that vision. He disagrees with Joe that the coal industry is dead. According to the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection, more than 40% of the state's rivers are too polluted to be used for drinking water or recreation or to support healthy aquatic life due to decades of mining. Joe Lovett's priority is to prevent coal extraction from continuing to wreak havoc on West Virginia's environment. He disagrees with Andrew that coal mining can continue in an environmentally responsible way. For this episode, I really wanted to get Andrew and Joe together to talk face to face. They both said that they were willing to do this, but when it got down to trying to actually schedule something, somehow it just never worked out. I was hoping that I could stand with Joe and Andrew on a mountainside that's been mined and reclaimed. I wanted them to look out and tell each other what they saw. But maybe they already understand what the other guy sees, and they just disagree.
We've been listening to a recent episode of the Us and Them podcast hosted by Trey Kay. Us and Them is produced by West Virginia Public Broadcasting and is supported in part by the West Virginia Humanities Council, the CRC Foundation, and the Daywood Foundation. You can find all of the Us and Them episodes at usandthempodcast.com. Before I let you go, we wanted to give you a heads up about what's coming up next week. We'll explore what happened to one community in southern West Virginia after residents were forced to move when the Army Corps of Engineers built the Bluestone Dam. This particular story has a connection to my own family's history. The village of Lily was settled by my ancestors. I traveled to the site where the community once stood.
So we're right at the junction with the Little Bluestone, where that comes in and meets the Bluestone River. So we're kind of sitting right here now, and you see the town was all around this area. So it really, I mean, it wasn't, when you say a town, I don't think it was this, all just one spot. It was really spread out over this whole area. Mm-hmm. And then way out into the outlying areas too, you know, lots of little farms all around the area. I mean, I can't even imagine what it would have been like coming down here back in the 1700s. You know, this area was the frontier back then. It was really a wilderness. You had to be pretty resourceful to survive back then. You know, there was nothing here.
Today, the village of Lily stands vacant along the Bluestone River. But before we hear that story, we wanted to know how Bluestone River got its name. That's our What's in a Name theme music. And as you know, we sometimes are curious about the stories behind Appalachian places and where the names come from. So because we're exploring the Bluestone River in our show next week, I couldn't help but ask Dave just how it got its name.
Bluestone River was probably called Bluestone because further up the river, beyond where it becomes a park, it used to, where there still are, I guess, limestone rocks in the river that have kind of a bluish tint to them.
By the way, Native Americans had another name for the Bluestone River. We've posted that name and a photo from the Bluestone River on our website at wvpublic.org. More on the story behind the village of Lily and the Bluestone River next week, right here on Inside Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Us and Them and the Allegheny Front. Music in today's show was provided by Marisa Anderson, Dinosaur Burps, Michael Howard, Blue Dot Sessions, and Ben Townsend. Our What's in a Name theme music is by Martika and William. Inside Appalachia is produced by myself, Jessica Lilly, and Roxy Todd. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Claire Hemme helped with our digital correspondence. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Downcast, wvpublic.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.